his head through the tarps and stood beside me. It made me feel much better having a representative of my family present. I thought, someday I hope I can help him as much. The women made my brother a sandwich. As for me, my head and shoulders were under cover, but the rest of me might as well have been under a rain spout. Paul was in the same shape, and no one made a move to push closer together and make room for us inside. The bastard had the whole upper end of the box to himself. Instead of lying all over the mattress, all he had to do was sit up. Outside, the water came down my back on a wide front, crowded into a narrow channel across my rear end, and then divided into two branches and emptied into my socks. When the women weren't using their hardware to make sandwiches for Neil, they were pointing it at me. I could smell all the sandwiches they weren't making for me, and I could smell water leaking through canvas and turning to vapor from the warmth of crowded bodies. And I could also smell the vapor of last night's booze rising from the old mattress. You probably know that Indians build their sweat baths on the banks of rivers. After they become drenched with sweat, they immediately jump into the cold water outside. And, it may be added, sometimes they immediately die. I felt that at the same time I was both halves of myself, and a sweat bath and a cold river, and about to die. I entertained a series of final thoughts. How could the bastard suffer from too much sun? The bastard hasn't seen more than a couple of hours of sunlight since he left Montana to go to the West Coast. I had a special thought for my wife. To keep things straight with her, I thought, I did not leave your brother. Your brother, who is a bastard, left me. All this, of course, was internal. For my mother-in-law, I tried to think of the time she must have committed adultery. For both my wife and her mother, I thought, the only thing the matter with a bastard is that all the antifreeze he poured into his radiator last night at Blackjack's has drained out. It rained all the way back to Wolf Creek, and we were stuck in the gumbo all the way from the Elkhorn to Jim McGregor's ranch house, where the road turned to gravel. Of course, Ken drove the truck, and Paul and I pushed. I pushed on an empty stomach. Just before I felt the sides of my stomach collapse, I went around to the driver's side of the cab and asked, Ken, how about getting your brother off his mattress to help us push? Ken said to me, you know more about a truck than that. You know I have to have ballast in the rear end or the rear wheels will just spin and not pull us out of the mud. I went back to the rear end and Paul and I pushed the ballast to the ranch house. It was just as hard pushing downhill as uphill. We might as well have been in eastern Montana pushing a half-ton truck plus ballast up the Powder River where they invented gumbo. When we reached Wolf Creek, Paul stayed to help me unload the truck, which was overweight with mud and water. We unloaded the mattress last. Then I started for bed, being all in, or maybe being just weak from hunger, and Paul left for Helena. On my way to my room, I saw Neil and his mother at the front door. The ballast had put on two red, white, and blue Davis Cup sweaters. He was lying to his mother, who had caught him before he got all the way out. He was in the pink of condition. I knew of two grocery crates who would be glad to see him. I went to bed and fought off sleep until I collected enough of my wits to come to a fairly obvious conclusion and to consolidate it into one sentence. If I don't get out of my wife's home for a few days, I am not going to have any wife left. So I telephoned my brother the next morning from the grocery store where no one at the house could hear. I asked him if he didn't have a little time coming yet from his summer vacation, because I needed to be at Seely Lake for a while. Seely Lake is where we have our summer cabin. It is only 17 miles from the Blackfoot Canyon and not much further from the Swan, a river beautiful as its name as it floats by the Mission Glaciers. I think my brother still felt yesterday's rain running down his back when no one moved to let us crawl under the tarp, so he understood what was on my mind. Anyway, he said, I'll ask the boss. That night I asked my wife a question. In dealing with her, I had a better chance to dominate the situation by asking a question than by making a series of declarative sentences. So I asked my wife, don't you think it would be a good idea for Paul and me to spend a few days at Seely Lake? She looked right through me and said, yes. I survived the next day and the day following, when Paul and I crossed the Continental Divide and left the world behind, so I thought. But the moment we started flowing into the Pacific, Paul began to tell me about a new girl he had picked up. I listened on my toes, ready to jump in any direction. I was in the same old box. Maybe he was telling me something I wouldn't like, but would dislike less if I heard it first as literature. Or maybe I was wasting my time and being suspicious. Maybe he was just my brother and a reporter passing on news items to me that were too personal or poetical to be published. "She's kind of funny," he said, when it was clear we were coasting down the western slope of our continent. "Yes," he said, as though I had commented, "she's kind of funny. The only place she'll let you screw her is in the boys' locker room in the high school gymnasium." What he said next sounded as if it also were an answer to something I had said, and maybe it was. "Oh, she's got that all figured out. She knows a window in the boys' toilet that's always unlocked, and I push her up, and then she reaches down and gives me a hand." The next he said on his own. "She makes you screw her on the rubbing table." I spent the rest of the way to Sealy Lake trying to figure out whether he was telling me he was in trouble with some dame, or whether he was seeing to it that I kept enlarging my mental life even though I had gone off and married. I went on thinking until I noticed that I could smell witch hazel, rubbing alcohol, hot radiators with sweat clothes drying on them, and the insides of boys' lockers that wouldn't be cleaned out until the end of the football season. I also thought, it's damn hot here right now. The fishing isn't going to be much good. The fish will all be lying on the bottom. Then I tried to imagine a fish lying on its back on a rubbing table. It was hard to keep things fluid and not to fix on the picture of the fish helping the fisherman through the window in the toilet of the boys' locker room. About then we drove into the big tamaracks where our cabin is. There, suddenly, it was cool. The tamaracks are from 8 to 1,200 years old, their age and height keeping the heat out. We went swimming even before we unloaded the car. After we had dressed, but before we had combed our hair, we carried out our swimming trunks and were hanging them on a clothesline that runs between two balsams. The line had been put up high where deer couldn't catch their horns in it, so I was standing on my toes trying to get a clothespin to stay when I heard a car turn off the Forest Service road into our lane. My brother said, "Don't look around." The car drove right up behind my back and stopped. Its engine panted in the heat. Even though it was panting in the curve of my back, I didn't look around. Then somebody fell out of its front door. When I looked, clothespin still in hand, I saw I'd been in error in thinking somebody had fallen out of the front door of the car, because the car had no front door. It had floorboards, though, in the front, and on the floorboards sat a Hills Brothers coffee can, a bottle of 3777, and an open bottle of strawberry pop. In Montana, we don't care whether the whiskey is much good if we can get strawberry pop for a chaser. Just as if the scene had been taken for a Western film, it was high noon. My brother-in-law nodded in the driver's seat, as he probably had all the way from Wolf Creek. Old Rawhide picked herself up out of the tamarack needles where she had fallen, took a look around to get reoriented, and then started walking straight for me. She would have walked through my brother if he hadn't reluctantly moved out of the way. "Glad to meet you," she said to me, reaching out toward my hand that held the clothespin. Mechanically, I shifted the clothespin to the other hand so she could shake the hand she was reaching for. Sometimes the thing in front of you is so big, you don't know whether to comprehend it first by getting a dim sense of the whole and then fitting in the pieces, or by adding up the pieces until something calls out what it is. I put only a few pieces together before my voice called to me, "You'll never make your brother believe you didn't sucker him into this." "How are you, anyway?" she asked. "I brought Buster to go fishing with you." She always called Neil Buster. She had slept with so many men that the problem of remembering their names boggled her mind. By now, all men besides Blackjack, Longbow, and her two rodeo artists she called Buster. Except me. Me she just called You. She could remember me, but she could never remember that she had met me. "Buster hasn't any money anymore," she said. "He needs your help." Paul said to me, "Help him." I asked, "How much money does he need?" "We don't want your money," she said. "We want to go fishing with you." She was drinking pink whiskey out of a pink paper cup. I went over to the car and asked the window next to the driver's seat, "You want to go fishing?" Clearly, he had memorized a line in case he could not hear. He said, "I would like to go fishing with you and Paul." I told him it's too hot to go fishing now. The dust was still drifting through the woods from the gravel turnoff to our lane. He repeated, "I would like to go fishing with you and Paul." Paul said, "Let's go." I said to Paul, "Let's all get in our car and I'll drive." Paul said, "I'll drive." And I said, "Okay." Old Rawhide and Neil didn't like the idea of all of us going in our car. I think they wanted to be alone, but they had become frightened or tired of being alone and wanted us somewhere around, though not in the front seat. Paul and I didn't argue. He got in the driver's seat and I sat next to him and they mumbled to themselves. Finally, she started moving their stuff to our back seat. First the pink pop and then the red Hills Brothers coffee can. I thought I noticed for the first time that they didn't have a fishing rod with them. If it had been anybody but Paul, I would have asked him to hold it a minute while I checked to see if their rods had been left in their car. But for Paul, the world of mercy did not include fishermen who left their tackle behind. He was tender to me and quick to offer them help, and would never kick about having to take them fishing at high noon while all the fish were lying at the bottom. But it would be just too damn bad for them if they didn't think enough about fishing to be able to fish when they got there. They leaned on each other and slept. I was glad I did not have to drive. I had too many things to feel about. For instance, I felt about why women are such a bunch of suckers, and how they all want to help some bastard like him, and not me. I felt an especially long time about why, when I tried to help somebody, I ended up offering him money or taking him fishing. One steep grade and we were out of the pines in the cool chain of lakes and into the glare of Blanchard Flats. Paul asked, "Which way do you want to turn when we get up to the junction with the Blackfoot Road?" "Up," I said. "The canyon's too rough water for them to fish. Let's turn up to the head of the canyon where there's some fine holes before the river goes into the cliffs." So we left the main road at the head of the flats and bumped over glacial remains until we came to a big fork in the river, with ponderosa pines beside it where we could park our car in the shade. In the middle of the river where it had forked was a long sandbar. If you could wade out there, you had a perfect fishing spot. Big fish on either side of you, and no sunken logs or big roots or rocks to foul you up when you were landing them. Just sand to skid them over so that they scarcely noticed they lay on land until they gasped for water. Although I had fished this hole many times, I went to take another look at it before I put up my rod. I approached it step by step, like an animal that's been shot at before. Once I had rushed down rod in hand to demolish a fish on the first cast, and actually had made the first cast when part of the mountain on the other side started falling into the river. I had never seen the bear, and he evidently had never seen me until he heard me swear when I was slow in reacting to the first strike. I didn't even know what the bear had been doing, fishing, swimming, drinking. All I know is that he led a landslide up the mountain. If you have never seen a bear go over the mountain, you have never seen the job reduced to its essentials. Now, of course, deer are faster, but not going straight uphill. Not even elk have the power in their hindquarters. Deer and elk zigzag and switch back and stop and pose while really catching their breath. The bear leaves the earth like a bolt of lightning retrieving itself and making its thunder backwards. Paul had his rod up when I got back to the car. He asked me, "Are Neil and his friend coming?" I looked in the back of the car where they were still asleep, except that they stirred when I merely looked, so maybe they weren't. I said, "Neil, wake up and tell us what you want to do." Much against his will, he made fitful efforts to wake up. Finally, he shed old Rawhide off his shoulder and got out of the car stiffly, already an old man. Looking over the bank, he asked, "What about that hole?" I told him, "It's a good one. In fact, so are the next four or five." "Can you wade out to the sandbar?" he asked. and I told him not usually, but it had been so hot lately the river had dropped a foot or more, and he shouldn't have any trouble. "That's what I'll do. I'll stay here and fish," Neil said. He never once referred to her. Besides being devoted to the art of ignoring women, he also knew that Paul and I didn't think she should be here, so he may have thought if he didn't mention her, we wouldn't notice her. Old Rawhide woke up and handed Paul the bottle of 3777. "Have a snort," she said. Paul took her hand and moved it around to where she was offering the drink to Neil. As I said, for several reasons, including our father, Paul and I did not drink when we fished. Afterwards, yes. In fact, as soon as our wet clothes were off and we can stand on them instead of the pine needles, one of us would reach for the glove compartment in the car where we always carried a bottle. If you think what I'm about to tell you next is a contradiction to this, then you will have to realize that in Montana, drinking beer does not count as drinking. Paul opened the trunk of our car and counted out 8 bottles of beer. He said to Neil, 4 for you, 4 for us. We'll sink 2 of them in each of the next 2 holes for you. They'll make you forget the heat. He told them where we would bury the bottles. And then he should have thought before he told them he would hide our beer in the 2 following holes, where we would finish fishing on our way back from the cliffs. What a beautiful world it was once. At least a river of it was. And it was almost mine and my family's, and just a few others who wouldn't steal beer. You could leave beer to cool in the river, and it would be so cold when you got back it wouldn't foam much. It would be a beer made in the next town if the town were 10,000 or over. So it was either Kessler beer made in Helena, or Highlander beer made in Missoula that we left to cool in the Blackfoot River. What a wonderful world it was once, when all the beer was not made in Milwaukee, Minneapolis, or St. Louis. We covered the beer with rocks so it wouldn't wash away. Then we started walking downstream a fishing distance. It was so hot even Paul was in no great rush. Suddenly he interrupted the lethargy. "Someday," he said, "Neil is going to find out about himself, and he won't come back to Montana. He doesn't like Montana." My only preparation for this remark was that I had seen him studying Neil's face when he was waking up. I said, "I know he doesn't like to fish. He just likes to tell women he likes to fish. It does something for him and the women, and for the fish, too," I added. "It makes them all feel better." It was so hot we stopped and sat on a log. When we were silent, we could hear the needles falling like dry leaves. Suddenly the needles stopped. "I should leave Montana," he said. "I should go to the West Coast." I had thought that too, but I asked, "Why?" "Here," he said, "I cover local sports and personal items in the police blotter. I don't have anything to do. Here I will never have anything to do." "Except fish and hunt," I told him. "And get into trouble," he added. I told him again, "I've told you before, I think I could be of some help if you want to work for a big paper. And maybe you could do your own stuff. Special features, even someday your own column." It was so hot that the mirages on the river melted into each other. It was hard to know whether the utterances I had heard were Delphic. He said, "Jesus, it's hot. Let's hit the river and cool off." He stood and picked up his rod, and his beautiful silk-wrapped rod shimmered like the air around it. "I'll never leave Montana," he said. "Let's go fishing." As we separated, he said, "And I like the trouble that goes with it." So we were back to where we had started, and it was so hot the fishing just couldn't be any good. And it wasn't. In the middle of a heat spell, death comes to running water at high noon. You cast and cast on top of it, and nothing comes up out of it. Not even frogs jump. You begin to think you were the only moving thing in it. Maybe in the evolutionary process, all life migrated from water to dry land, all except you, and you were on the way with a part of you not in the water parching in the unaccustomed air. With the sun bouncing back at you from the water and hitting under your eyebrows, even your hat doesn't do any good. I knew it was going to be tough before I started, so I tried to be extra sharp. I fished in front and back of big rocks where the fish could be in the shade, and the water would bring them food without their having to work for it. I concentrated, too, on the water that slid under bushes, where the fish could lie in the shade and wait for insects to hatch in the limbs and drop before them. There was nothing in the shade but shadows. On the assumption that if an idea doesn't produce anything at all, then the opposite might work, I gave up shade entirely and walked into the open meadow that was crackling with grasshoppers. To one familiar with the subject, there is no trouble to find reasons for the opposite idea. I said to myself, "It is summer, and the grasshoppers are out in the sun, and the fish will be too." I put on a cork-bellied fly that looked like one of those big, juicy yellow hoppers. I fished close to shore, where even big fish wait for grasshoppers to make one mistake. After fishing with a floating cork grasshopper, I put on a big fly with a yellow wool body that would absorb water and sink like a dead grasshopper. Still, not even a frog jumped. The brain gives up a lot less easily than the body, so fly fishermen have developed what they call the curiosity theory, which is about what it says it is. It is the theory that fish, like men, will sometimes strike things just to find out what they are and not because they look good to eat. With most fly fishermen, it is the last resort theory, but it sometimes almost works. I put on a fly that George Kroonenbergs had tied for me when he was a kid, and several decades before he became one of the finest fly tiers of the West. This fly, tied in a moment of juvenile enthusiasm, had about everything on it from deer hair to fool hen feathers. Once when I was fishing on the upper Blackfoot, I saw a strange thing with a neck and a head being washed downstream while trying to swim straight across. I couldn't figure out what it was until it landed and shook itself. Then I recognized that it was a bobcat. And in case you don't know what a wet bobcat looks like, it looks like a little wet cat. While this one was wet, it was a skinny, meek little thing. But after it got dry and fluffy again and felt sure that it was a cat once more, it turned around, took a look at me and hissed. I hope my old fishing pal George Kroonenbergs doesn't mind my saying that this juvenile creation of his struggling in the water looked something like the bobcat. Anyway, it looked like something interesting to a fish. Out of the lifeless and hopeless depths, life appeared. It came so slowly it seemed as if he and history were being made on the way. After a while, he got to be 10 inches long. He came closer and closer, but beyond a certain point, he never got any bigger, so I guess that's how big he was. At what seemed a safe distance, the 10-incher began to circle George's bobcat special. I have never seen such large, disbelieving eyes in such a little fish. He kept his eyes always on the fly and seemed to let the water circle him around it. Then he turned himself over to gravity and slowly sank. When he got to be about a 6-incher, he reversed himself and became a 10-incher again to give George's fly a final inspection. Halfway around the circle, he took his eye off the fly and saw me and darted out of sight. This undoubtedly is the only time that a fish ever seriously studied George's juvenile creation, although I still carry it with me for sentimental reasons. I abandoned the curiosity theory, got down on my belly and had a drink of water, and was thirstier when I finished. I began to think of that beer and of quitting this waste of time. In fact, I would have quit and sat in the shade, except that I didn't want to be sitting in the shade when my brother asked, "How many did you get?" And I had to answer, "I went for the horse collar." So I said to myself prayerfully, "I'll try one more hole." I don't like to pray and not have my prayers come true, so I walked a long way on the bank looking for this last prayerful hole. When I saw it, actually, I wasn't looking hard because it was an ordinary piece of water. But when I took a sudden second look, I could see that fish were jumping all over it. Almost at the same moment, I smelled something, and it smelled bad. In fact, on a hot day, it smelled very bad. I didn't want to get any closer, but hitherto non-existent fish were jumping right in front of me. I circled the dead beaver halfway down the bank and made for the water. I knew I was set. When I saw the dead beaver, I knew why the fish were jumping. Even a weekend fisherman would know that the dead beaver had drawn a swarm of bees that were flying low over the ground and water. Being my kind of fisherman, I knew I had the right fly to match them, and I did not think that my brother would. He didn't carry many flies. They were all in his hat band, 20 or 25 at the most, but really only four or five kinds, since each one was in several sizes. They were what fishermen call generals, each a fly with which a skillful fisherman can imitate a good many insects, and in different stages, from larval to winged. My brother felt about flies much the way my father, who was a fine carpenter, felt about tools. He maintained anybody could make a good showing as a carpenter if he had enough tools. But I wasn't a good enough fisherman to be disdainful of tools. I carried a box full of flies, the generals, and also what fishermen call the specials, flies that imitate a very specific hatch, such as flying ants, mayflies, stoneflies, spruce bugs, and bees. I took a fly out of my box that George Kroonenberg's had tied to imitate a bee. It didn't look much like a bee. If you're starting to be a fly fisherman, you better be careful not to confuse yourself with the fish and buy counter flies, flies that in a drugstore counter look to you like the insect they were named after. George had a glass tank in his backyard, which he filled with water. Then he would lie under it and study the insect he was going to imitate, floating on top, where it doesn't look like an insect anywhere else. I put on George's bee that did not look like a bee, and caught three just like that. They were nice size, but not big. 14 inches or so. Still, I was grateful to get the horse collar off my neck. Somehow it's hard to quit with an odd number of fish, so I wanted one more for four, but I had to work hard to get him. When I finally did, he was small, and I knew that he was the last and that the rest had got wise to George's bee. The increasing heat of the afternoon had the opposite effect on the dead beaver, and he gathered strength. So I climbed the bank and walked into the wind to the next bend where I could sit and look downstream for Paul. Now he could ask me, and I wouldn't be ashamed to be caught sitting in the shade. I sat there in the hot afternoon, trying to forget the beaver and trying to think of the beer. Trying to forget the beaver, I also tried to forget my brother-in-law and old Rawhide. I knew I was going to have a long time to sit here and forget, because my brother would never quit with three or four fish, as I had, and even he was going to have a hard time getting more. I sat there and forgot, until what remained was the river that went by and I who watched. On the river, the heat mirages danced with each other, and then they danced through each other, and then they joined hands and danced around each other. Eventually, the watcher joined the river, and there was only one of us. I believe it was the river. Even the anatomy of a river was laid bare. Not far downstream was a dry channel where the river had run once, and part of the way to come to know a thing is through its death. But years ago, I had known the river when it flowed through this now dry channel, so I could enliven its stony remains with the waters of memory. In death, it had its pattern, and we can only hope for as much. Its overall pattern was the favorite serpentine curve of the artist sketched on the valley from my hill to the last hill I could see on the other side. But internally, it was made of sharp angles. It ran seemingly straight for a while, turned abruptly, then ran smoothly again, then met another obstacle, again was turned sharply, and again ran smoothly. Straight lines that couldn't be exactly straight and angles that couldn't have been exactly right angles became the artist's most beautiful curve and swept from here across the valley to where it could be no longer seen. I also became the river by knowing how it was made. The Big Blackfoot is a new glacial river that runs and drops fast. The river is a straight rapids until it strikes big rocks or big trees with big roots. This is the turn that is not exactly at right angles. Then it swirls and deepens among big rocks and circles back through them where big fish live under the foam. As it slows, the sand and small rocks it picked up in the fast rapids above begin to settle out and are deposited, and the water becomes shallow and quiet. After the deposit is completed, it starts running again. On a hot afternoon, the mind can also create fish and arrange them according to the way it has just made the river. It will have the fish spend most of their time in the big blue at the turn, where they can lie protected by big rocks and take it easy and have food washed to them by big waters. From there, they can move into the fast rapids above when they're really hungry. Or it is September and cool, but it is hard work living in such fast water all the time. The mind that arranges can also direct the fish into the quiet water in the evening, when gnats and small moths come out. Here the fisherman should be told to use his small dry flies and to wax them so they will float. He should also be informed that in quiet evening water everything must be perfect, because with the glare from the sun gone, the fish can see everything. So even a few hairs too many in the tail of the fly can make all the difference. The mind can make all these arrangements, but, of course, the fish do not always observe them. Fishermen also think of the river as having been made with them partly in mind, and they talk of it as if it had been. They speak of the three parts as a unity and call it a whole, and the fast rapids they call the head of the whole, and the big turn they call the deep blue or pool, and the quiet, shallow water below they call the tail of the whole, which they think is shallow and quiet, so that they can have a place to wade across and try the other side. As the heat mirages on the river in front of me danced with and through each other, I could feel patterns from my own life joining with them. It was here, while waiting for my brother, that I started this story. Although, of course, at the time I did not know that stories of life are often more like rivers than books. But I knew a story had begun, perhaps long ago, near the sound of water. And I sensed that ahead I would meet something that would never erode. So there would be a sharp turn, deep circles, a deposit, and quietness. The fisherman even has a phrase to describe what he does when he studies the patterns of a river. He says he is reading the water. And perhaps to tell the stories, he has to do much the same thing. Then one of his biggest problems is to guess where and at what time of day life lies ready to be taken as a joke, and to guess whether it's going to be a little or a big joke. For all of us, though, it is much easier to read the waters of tragedy. Did you do any good? The voice and the question suggested that if I woke up and looked around, I would see my brother. The suggestion became a certainty when the voice asked, "What the hell are you doing here?" "Oh, just thinking," I answered, as we all answer when we don't know what we've been doing. He said it was too hot to fish, but he had fished until he caught a fairly good mess, which meant 10 or 12 and just fair-sized. "Let's go and get that beer," he said. When he said beer, everything else came back to me. The beer, the beaver, the brother-in-law, and his fishing companion. "God, let's get that beer," I said. Paul kept spinning a bottle opener around his little finger. We were so dry that we could feel in our ears that we were trying to swallow. For talk, we only repeated the lyric refrain of the summer fisherman. "A bottle of beer would sure taste good." A game trail cut from the bank to the river where we had left the beer for ourselves, and we went down it stiff-legged. Paul was ahead, and when he got near the bottom, he loosened his knees and made for the river. We had buried the beer in moving water to keep it cool, but not where the water was so fast it would wash the beer downstream. "I can't see it," he said, feeling with his feet. "Oh," I said, "you just haven't found the right place. It has to be there." And I waded out to find it for him, already having doubts that I could. He said, "There's no use looking around. That's where we buried it." He pointed to holes in the clay at the bottom where we had pulled out rocks to cover the bottles. I felt in one of the holes with the toe of my wading boot, as if a bottle of beer might have escaped my attention in a hole the size of a small rock. He was doing the same thing. There were no bottles of beer hiding in holes too small for a bottle to get into. We had been saving our thirst for a long time. Now knee-deep by the holes in the clay bottom, we cupped our hands and started drinking out of the river. Between us and the car, there were still three more holes where we had buried the beer, but we had about quit hoping for beer. Paul said, "All told, we buried 8 bottles of beer in 4 holes. Do you think they could have drunk 8 bottles of beer besides the rest of that 3777? He was being gentle, for my sake and for the sake of my wife and my mother-in-law. But I couldn't argue against anything he was thinking. Although we had walked back on the trail, we were always in sight of the river, and neither of us had seen a fisherman. Who else could have taken it? I said, "Paul, I'm sorry. I wish I knew how I could have stayed away from this guy." "You couldn't," he said. Suddenly we did something that for a time seemed strange to me. Given the fact that we knew without hurrying to look that all the beer was gone, and that we also knew without evidence who had taken it. Suddenly we turned and came out of that water with a roar, like two animals as they finish fording a river, making jumps when the water gets shallower and bringing waves to shore long after they get there. Later I could see easily that our being gentle was for each other, and the roar and the jumps to the shore were for those who had taken our beer. The rocks rattled and leaped out of our way as we walked along the shore. In each of the next three holes, we enacted the rite of staring at the emptiness of stones that have been rolled aside. We came then to where in the distance we could see our car on the bank, and where below the river forked with a sandbar in between. Nobody had moved the car to keep it in the shade. I could feel how hot it would be if we rubbed against a fender while shedding our wet clothes. I said, "I don't see them." "I don't either," Paul said. "They can't be in the car," I said. He added, "Today a dog would die in a car if he were left in it." Walking fast and watching for them, I wasn't watching where I was going, and stumbled over a rock and lit on my elbow, which I'd stuck out to avoid falling on my rod. I was picking the grit out of my cut when Paul said, "What's on the sandbar?" Still trying to pick the blue-black specks out of my bruise, I said, "Maybe it's the bear." "What bear?" he asked. "The bear that went over the mountain," I told him. "That's where he comes down the mountain to drink." "That's no bear," he said. I studied the sandbar. "Maybe it's two bears," I suggested. "It's two, all right," he said, "but it's not bears." "Why do you keep saying it when it's two?" I asked him. "It's not bears," he said. "It's red." "Wait until you see it go up the mountain," I told him. "Then you'll see it's bears. Bears go straight up a mountain." We were walking very slowly now, as if ready to jump sideways if it moved suddenly. "It's red," he said, "and it's whatever drank our beer." I told him, "It isn't even human. It's red, as you say." By now we had come to an uneasy stop, like animals approaching a waterhole and seeing something in the water where they were going to drink. We didn't snort or paw, but we could feel what it would be like to snort and paw. We had no choice but to go ahead. We kept going till we knew, but couldn't believe it. "Bear hell," Paul said. "It's a bear ass." "Two bear asses," I said. "That's what I meant," he said. "It's two bear asses, both are red." We kept not believing after we knew. "I'll be a son of a bitch," Paul said. "Me too," I said to confirm it. You have never really seen an ass until you have seen two sunburned asses on a sandbar in the middle of a river. Nearly all the rest of the body seems to have evaporated. The body is a large red ass about to blister, with hair on one end of it for a head and feet attached to the other end for legs. By tonight, it will run a fever. That's the way it looked then, but when I view it now, through the sentimentality of memory, it belongs to a pastoral world where you could take off your clothes, screw a dame in the middle of the river, then roll over on your belly and go to sleep for a couple of hours. If you tried something like that on the Blackfoot River these days, half the city of Great Falls would be standing on the shore waiting to steal your clothes when you went to sleep. Maybe sooner. "Hey!" Paul yelled with a hand on each side of his mouth. Then he blasted a whistle with a finger from each hand. "You think they're all right?" he asked me. "You used to work every summer in the sun in the Forest Service." "Well," I told him, "I never knew anybody who died of sunburn, but they sure as hell aren't going to wear any wool underwear for a couple of weeks." "Let's get into the car," he said. We took off our baskets and leaned our rods against a log so they could be seen and nobody would step on them. We had waded almost to the sandbar when Paul stopped and barred me with his arm. "Just a minute," he said. "I want to take another look so I'll always remember." We stood there for a minute and made an engraving on what little was left of the blank tablets of our minds. It was an engraving in color. In the foreground of the engraving was a red Hills Brothers coffee can, then red tenderized soles of feet pointing downward, two red asses sizzling under the solar system, and in the background a pile of clothes with her red panties on top. To the side were the remains of the 3777, red hot when touched. There was no fishing rod or basket in sight. Paul said, "May he get 3 doses of clap, and may he recover from all but the first." I never again threw a line in this hole, which I came to regard as a kind of wild game sanctuary. We waded the rest of the way to the sandbar without splashing, fearful of waking them. I think we thought, when they wake up, they will start peeling. I know what I thought. I had worked several summers in rattlesnake country in late August, and I thought, when they wake up and find out how hot it is, they will shed their skins and be blind for a while and strike at anything they hear. I can remember I kept thinking, they will be very dangerous when they wake up. So I walked around them warily, staying beyond striking distance. When we got close to them, they developed anatomical parts that couldn't be seen from shore. They developed legs between their asses and their feet, and they sprouted backs and necks, especially necks, between their asses and their hair. It was red into their hair, which was curly. It was hard to know whether their hair was naturally curly or whether it had frizzled in the sun. Each hair was distinct and could have been made with a hot curling iron. Paul had gone over to see what was left in the bottle of 3777, but I stayed to study the anatomy. Each hair was sore at its root, but that's not what I backed off to tell Paul. I was so studious I backed off until I bumped into him. "She's got a tattoo on her ass," I told him. "No kidding," he said. He circled her as if to get on the downwind side of big game before trying to approach it. Then he backed off and completed the circle back to me. "What are the initials of her cowboys?" he asked. "B.I. and B.L., I told him. He said, "Are you sure?" I said, "Sure, I'm sure." "Well," he said, "they don't fit, because she has L.O. tattooed on one cheek of her ass and V.E. on the other." I told him, "L.O.V.E. spells love, with a hash mark between." "I'll be damned," he said, and backed away, circled around, and started to study the situation all over again. She jumped straight up like a barber pole. She was red, white, and blue. She was white, where she'd been lying on her belly in the sand, and her back completed the patriotic color scheme, red into her hair, except for the blue-black tattoo. Somebody should have spun her around and played the Stars and Stripes forever. She looked wildly about her to get oriented, and then streaked for the clothes pile and pulled on her red panties. When she was sure you couldn't look without paying at the part that made her living, she relaxed. She didn't put on any more clothes, but came sauntering back, took one look at me and said, "Oh, it's you." Then she looked at both of us and said, "Well, what's on your mind, boys?" She was ready to entertain company. I said, "We came out to get Neil." She was disappointed. "Oh," she said, "you mean Buster." I said, "I mean him." And when I pointed at him, he groaned. I think he did not want to wake up and find out about his sunburn and hangover. He groaned again and sank even deeper into the sand. Her white belly was covered with sand and had creases in it where her skin had folded over when she was lying on it. Sand ran out of her navel. Paul said, "Get your clothes on and help us with him." She looked indignant. She said, "I can take care of him." Paul said, "You already have." She said, "He's my man. I can take care of him. The sun doesn't bother me." And I suppose she was right. It's under the sun where a fisherman's whore makes her money. Paul said, "Get your clothes on or I'll kick you in the ass." Both she and I knew he meant it. Paul went over to the clothes pile and started separating out Neil's clothes from hers. They were in the order in which they had come off. That's why her red pants were on top of the pile and her belt on the bottom. I said to Paul, "That's a good thing to do, but we can't put any clothes on him. I don't think he can stand their touch." "We'll take him home naked then," Paul said. When Neil heard the word home, he sat up so suddenly that the sand ran off him in streams. "I don't want to go home," he said. "Where do you want to go, Neil?" I asked. "I don't know," he said, "but I don't want to go home." I told him, "There are 3 women there who know how to take care of you." "I don't want to see 3 women," he said, and more sand ran off him. Old Rawhide held her clothes under one arm. I reached down, picked up Neil's clothes, and put them under his arm. Here, I said, taking his other arm. I'll help you wade back to shore. He jumped away in pain. Don't touch me, he said. To old Rawhide, he said, You carry my clothes. They hurt when I hold them. You take them, she said to me, and I did. And she took Neil by the arm he had pulled away from me and led him to the edge of the water. Partway out, she turned around and said to me, He's my man. She was a strong woman and very tough. The Blackfoot is a big river and hard to wade. The man couldn't have made it without the strength in her legs. Partway across, Paul turned around and went back for what was left of the bottle of 3777. After old Rawhide got Neil all the way across, she left him feeling his way through the rocks with his tenderized feet and waded back to the sandbar. Her feet were tenderized too, but she waded back to the sandbar to get the Hills Brothers coffee can. I met her on the shore when she returned. What's good about the coffee can? I asked her. I don't know, she said, but Buster always likes to have it with him. There was a light blanket on the back seat of the car that we used to spread on the ground when we were going to have a picnic. Fir needles had stuck on it. We put Neil and old Rawhide in the back seat and threw the light blanket over them, probably for several reasons. Probably to keep them from getting further burned, especially by the wind, and probably also so the state police wouldn't arrest us for indecent exposure. But the moment the blanket touched their shoulders, they writhed until it fell off. So we drove to Wolf Creek, completely exposed to the elements and the police. Neil never sat up straight, but he murmured from time to time, I don't want to see three women. Each time he murmured this, old Rawhide would sit up straight and say, Don't worry, I'm your woman, I'll take care of you. I was driving. Each time he murmured this, I took a firm grip on the wheel. I didn't want to see three women either. For most of the trip, Paul and I didn't speak to each other or to them. We just let one murmur through his armpit and the other jump up straight and then recede into the clothes pile. But as we neared Wolf Creek, I could feel Paul getting ready to change the format. Slowly, his body shifted until he could reach to the back seat. A murmur came again. I don't want to go home. Paul reached and grabbed the arm that belonged to the armpit and pulled him up. The arm turned white, even when it was sunburned. You're almost home, Paul said. There's no other place you can go. There were no more murmurs. Paul kept holding the arm. The whore was still tough, and she and Paul got into a big argument. Paul was used to talking to tough women, and she was used to tough talk. The argument was over whether we were going to dump her as soon as we got to town, or whether she was going to stay and take care of Buster. Mostly what was said was, God damn you, I am, and God damn you, you're not. He said to me, as part of the argument, When you get to town, stop at the Log Dance Hall. The Log Dance Hall was the first building at the edge of town. It was a good place to have fights. And there'd been plenty of them there, especially on Saturday nights. Every time some hometown drunk from Wolf Creek tried to dance with a girl of some drunk who had come from the Dearborn country. You couldn't tell by the profanity who was winning the argument, but as we got closer to town, she would reach into the clothes pile and put some of it on her. There's a bend in the creek in the road just before you get to the Log Dance Hall. When she saw the bend, she realized she wouldn't have all her clothes on by the time we reached the dance hall, so she scurried through the pile, grabbing the rest that belonged to her. Just as I stopped the car, she made one wild grab into the pile, opened the door of the car, and jumped out. She was on the opposite side of the car from Paul and must have figured that would give her a big enough head start. She left the back door swinging and took a good hold on the clothes in her arms. At the top of the clothes in her arms was Neil's underwear, which she had taken either by accident or for a keepsake. She made one more grunt as she tightened her hold on her belongings, like a packer throwing a double diamond hitch just to be sure the whole load will stick together on the rough trip ahead. Then she said to my brother, You stinking bastard. Paul came out of that car as if the body of it had fallen off and took after her. I think I knew how he felt. Much as he hated her, he really had no strong feeling about her. It was the bastard in the back seat without any underwear that he hated. The bastard who had ruined most of our summer fishing. The bait-fishing bastard. the bait-fishing bastard who had violated everything that our father had taught us about fishing by bringing a whore and a coffee can of worms, but not a rod. The bait-fishing bastard who had screwed his whore in the middle of our family river, and after drinking our beer. The bastard right in the back of the car who was untouchable because of three Scotch women. She was running barefoot and trying to hang on to the rest of her clothes and his underwear, so Paul caught up to her in about 10 jumps. On the run, he kicked her, I think, right where the L-O and the V-E came together. For several seconds, both of her feet trailed behind her in the air. It was to become a frozen moment of memory. When I could move, I took 2 quick looks at my brother-in-law and counted to 4. The 4 was for those 4 women in the street ready to protect him, 1 in the middle of the street and 3 in a house partway down it. Suddenly, I developed a passion to kick a woman in the ass. I was never aware of such a passion before, but now it overcame me. I jumped out of the car and caught up to her, but she had been kicked in the ass before and by experts, so I missed her completely. Still, I felt better for the effort. Paul and I stood together and watched her hightail it down the road through town. She had no choice. She lived on the other side of a town, which is in a narrow gulch. After she got near home, she stopped several times to look back, and Paul and I didn't like what we couldn't hear she was saying. Each of these times we pretended that we were going to start after her again, and she edged closer to her shack. Finally, she and her clothes pile disappeared, and we were left with a back seat. "Now we haven't anything left to do but take him home," my brother said. As we walked back to the car, he added, "You're in trouble." I know," I said. But I didn't really know. I still didn't know what Scottish women look like when they struggle to keep their pride and haven't much reason left to keep it. In case you have any doubts, they keep it. Even Neil tried to pull himself together. He tried to put on some clothes before the women saw him. He piled his clothes outside the car, and when he couldn't find his underwear, he started trying to get into his pants, but he stumbled and kept stumbling. He held his pants out in front of him and tried to catch up to them. He was stumbling so fast he was running after them, but he never got any closer to them than an arm's length. He was breathless when we caught him, and he gasped when we put on his pants. His feet were too swollen for shoes. We put his shirt over his shoulders with its tails hanging out. When we brought him into the house, he looked like something shipwrecked we had found on an island. Florence came out of the kitchen, and when she saw what Paul and I had, she began drying her hands on her dish towel. "What have you done to my boy?" she asked the brothers who were holding him up. Jessie then followed from the kitchen when she heard her mother. She was tall and red-headed anyway, and I was shrunken before her from trying to hold up her brother. "You bastard," she said to me. The bastard I was holding weighed a ton. "No," Paul said. "Get out of the way," I told her. "We have to put him to bed." "He's badly sunburned," Paul said. The women I was brought up with never stood around trying on different lifestyles when there was something to be done, especially something medical. Most people have an immediate chemical reaction to shrink from pain or disfigurement, but the women I was brought up with were magnetized by the medical. "Let's get him undressed," Florence said, backing to the bedroom door and holding it open.